Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantagraph of Friday, June 26, 2026. We turn first to page one, where the main story is about Pride Month, titled Gender Euphoria, A Safe and Joyful Space. Growing grassroots group serves the Bloomington Normal trans community. This story is datelined Bloomington. The first night that Gender Euphoria met, Kellen Tice was not sure how many people would show up, and then the room filled. There were so many people who I met that night who said, "I have never met another trans person. I have never been in a room with this many trans people," said Tice, age 38. "It was just so moving, and even now I get chills thinking about it." A little more than a year later, Gender Euphoria has become a local grassroots community group dedicated to creating safe and private spaces for transgender, non-binary, gender non-conforming, and questioning people in Bloomington Normal and beyond. The group meets monthly at the Bistro in downtown Bloomington and has expanded into other events, including library gatherings, outdoor events, and a gender-affirming closet that provides free clothing. For its organizers, the group is meant to offer something that can be simple but difficult to find, a space where trans people can be together without having to explain themselves. It is a safe space to know that everyone is going to pronoun you or gender you correctly, said Lex Lowell, 24, who uses they and them pronouns. It is also a way to connect with each other. Tice and Casey Roy, 29, founded Gender Euphoria. The two met when Tice sat in Roy's barber chair, and they realized that they shared a similar goal, building a stronger trans community in Bloomington Normal. Roy, who uses he-him pronouns, moved to Bloomington Normal from Texas, where he said he had lived in places with more visible trans communities. Here, he found broader LGBTQIA plus spaces, but fewer spaces specifically centered on trans and gender nonconforming people. "I wanted to kind of create a private party for us to come together and invite trans people or gender nonconforming people to get together," Roy said. The group now meets from 6 to 8 p.m. on the last Saturday of each month at the Bistro. Though organizers said the July gathering will be tied to Pride Fest, which will be from 4 to 10 p.m. July 25th in downtown Bloomington, before the group resumes its regular monthly schedule in August. The monthly events are primarily social. People talk, play games, catch up, and build friendships that often continue outside of the group's formal gathering. Organizers have also hosted holiday potlucks, including a Transgiving meal, LGBTQIA plus history trivia, and other events. Roy said the first Gender Euphoria event drew nearly 100 people, including some from other parts of Illinois and from surrounding states. As with many new events, attendance dipped after the first gathering, but organizers kept showing each month. And now, Roy said, the group regularly sees about 50 to 70 people at monthly events. "Everyone knows each other," Roy said. "There's friend groups within Gender Euphoria now. I think my favorite part is seeing them out in the world together, hanging out when it's not Gender Euphoria." Lowell found the group after moving to Bloomington Normal, and they first came across Gender Euphoria at Pride Fest about a week after arriving. Since then, Lowell has become one of the people helping expand what the group offers. They started the Gender Affirming Closet, a free clothing resource that began as a way to help trans people access clothes that fit how they want to present themselves. "When transitioning, it's hard to get those clothes, and it's a lot of money," Lowell said. The closet has since expanded beyond trans people to anyone in the community who needs clothing, Lowell said. They have also helped organize events such as trans femme makeup programming and worked to spread the word about the group through flyers, Instagram, and other community spaces. Without gender euphoria, Lowell said, they are not sure they would have stayed in Bloomington Normal. I probably would have moved back home, Lowell said. I would not have found the people who truly made my life for the better. The group also holds events outside the bistro because organizers know not everyone can or wants to gather in a bar setting. Some people are under 21, some avoid spaces where alcohol is present, and others may simply feel more comfortable in libraries, parks, or other public spaces. Roy said the bistro has been supportive of the group, and organizers credited owner Jan Lancaster for helping them make the monthly gatherings possible. Prairie Pride Coalition has also served as Gender Euphoria's financial sponsor, helping to pay for events, supplies, and growth. Organizers said the group is not meant to replace broader LGBTQIA plus spaces in Bloomington Normal. Instead, it fills a more specific need. Roy said general LGBTQIA plus spaces are important, but trans and gender nonconforming people often need a space where others understand parts of their experience without explanation. It's very valuable to have a private, safe space where you can share and be in a community with other trans and gender nonconforming people, Roy said. For Tice, who uses he, they pronouns, that sense of community can be powerful. A lot of trans people do not have a supportive community, and it can be really scary and isolating, Tice said. Having a sense of community is so important because it helps keep people alive. It helps keep people happy. Tice said gender euphoria is not only about support in difficult moments, it is also about joy. Trans joy is so important right now, Tice said. The group's name comes from the idea of gender euphoria, the opposite of gender dysphoria, which some trans people experience when their body, presentation, or social treatment does not align with their gender. For Roy, gender euphoria is about feeling aligned with himself. It's the things about myself that I do see and feel aligned with, Roy said. When I can feel my most masculine self and not feel like I need to change or conform in a way that makes other people feel comfortable. For Lowell, gender euphoria means feeling safe in their body and free to express themselves. They said being non-binary in a smaller community can sometimes mean challenging people's assumptions about gender. People are more confused about it, Lowell said. I kind of like to push people's boundaries of what they think gender is and what the binary is. Organizers said one misconception about trans people is that they are somehow separate from everyday community life. Roy said trans people are already part of Bloomington Normal, working jobs, building friendships, and living ordinary lives. We are simply just people, Roy said. We are the people who cut your hair. We're the people that serve your drinks. We are the people who deliver your mail. Gender Euphoria maintains private online spaces, including on Facebook and Discord, where members can learn about events and connect. Organizers said conversations in those spaces are expected to stay private, though members are welcome to share photos with friends or tag the group's Instagram when appropriate. The group's monthly event is for trans, gender nonconforming, and questioning people. Allies may be invited to specific events when organizers say so publicly. If you are questioning, please feel free, Lowell said. We want this also to be a space that people can do that. Roy said the group tries to be welcoming to new people and clear about expectations. Everyone is really good about being like, hey, what's your name? What's your pronoun? Roy said. Everyone's very welcoming when we see a new face. For organizers, the goal is to keep creating a place where people can find friendship, resources, and a sense of belonging. Tice said the group is still young and members already have expressed interest in more programming, including mutual aid, nature-focused gatherings, family-friendly events, and movie nights. Lowell said the social nature of the group is part of what makes it valuable. Unlike a formal support group, Gender Euphoria gives people a chance to relax, laugh, and be with friends without centering only the hard parts of being trans. It was fun, Lowell said. I didn't have to think about all the sad stuff going on in the world or in my life. I could just see my friends and have a smile. And our next front page story is titled Tucker Leaving Ewing Legacy, Director Retiring After Manor Restoration. This story is Dateline Bloomington. Tony Tucker came to Ewing Manor with a vision of restoring the historic mansion to its former glory in time for its centennial in 2028. Feeling that the job is substantially complete, she said it's time to retire. And in recognition of her work, the City of Bloomington has declared June 26, 2026, as Tony Tucker Appreciation Day. Tucker started as Ewing Cultural Center Director in 2012. Since then, she has worked to preserve the structure and grounds at Emerson Street and Towanda Avenue in Bloomington, as well as its history and the story of Davis and Hazel Buck Ewing, the couple who built it and left it to the Illinois State University Foundation. Over her 14 years at the mansion, Tucker has acquired over 100,000 documents, photos, and artifacts, and has been able to secure funding to make the archive a permanent collection. As I leave, I think leaving the legacy of this archive to the community is something that I am very proud of, said Tucker. Bloomington Mayor Dan Brady issued a proclamation on June 8th with deep appreciation for the service of Tony Tucker and wish her well in all her future endeavors. Her official retirement date is set for June 30th. A retirement reception will be held 1 to 3 p.m. June 26th in room 116 at the ISU Alumni Center at 1101 North Main Street in Normal. Although she says she knew nothing about the Ewings when she took the job offer, Tucker has now fostered relationships with the descendants of the original owners of the Channel Norman-style home. The Ewings called the house, built in 1928 to 1929, and what was then a 60-acre estate, Sunset Hill, but it is more commonly known as Ewing Manor, or to many older local residents, Ewing Castle. Through tears, Tucker recalled a memory involving Ted Ewing, the grandson of Hazel Buck and Davis Ewing, and a portrait of Hazel that had been taken from the manor years before to another family home in Wisconsin. Tucker came up with an agreement with the family, which would allow her to restore and digitize the portrait and hang a copy at Ewing Manor. The family planned to keep the original painting in the Wisconsin home. But after the portrait was finished and uncrated at the Bloomington mansion, Ted looked at Tucker with tears in his eyes and said, "She's home," Tucker said. "I just wanted it as a copy. I never intended that they would give it to us," Tucker said. Dan Leifel, who serves as a volunteer at Ewing Manor, described this incident as just one of many examples that illustrate how the director has been able to bring life back into the manor, preserving its memories. Tucker, who earned a bachelor's degree in education in 1986 from Purdue University and a master's degree in information and library science in 2003 from Dominican University, spent the majority of her career at Illinois State University's Milner Library. She began her career in 1999 as the assistant dean of marketing and public relations before moving into her current role, which also includes the title of Associate Director for University Advancement. Tucker recalled being asked to apply for her current position by then Vice President of the University Advancement, Aaron Minet. "I thought, I've been to Ewing Cultural Center a couple of times, but I knew nothing about it," Tucker said. She remembered thinking there was not a chance that she would get the job after applying, but to her surprise, she was chosen. "When they called and offered me the position, I was just shocked," Tucker said. And she began her job on May 29, 2012, a day she says she will never forget. Right away, Tucker read the intent of the facility as spelled out in Hazel's will. From there, she started forming a plan to maintain the home and open it to the public as the late owner had intended. Wanting to more fully realize Hazel's desire for the home to be open to the public as a cultural hub, Tucker got to working on a restoration not only of the building itself, but also of the relationships with the descendants of the Ewing family. After over a decade of restoration of the manor, Tucker completed her goals April 20th, when the last of 104 windows was restored and installed, bringing the multi-year project to a close. Illinois Appellate Court Justice Jim Kinect said he has been involved with the manor in some capacity for the past 48 years as a member of the Ewing Advisory Committee and the Foundation Board, which oversees Ewing Manor in conjunction with the trust. He said that although the manor has seen a number of good directors, Tucker was the perfect person for the historical aspect of it, the archive aspect of it, the use of it in good ways, and the connection with the Ewing family. Working with her has just been marvelous, he said, citing the growth achieved under Tucker's leadership. Marcia Young, who was involved as a co-director of the University Museums on the ISU campus, said she also got to experience the shift with Tucker. Young had been involved with the manor since the mid-1980s, when the home was being used as a museum. For me, Tony has created an interpreted space in this building, not to mention the restoration, which is absolutely phenomenal, that has transformed and integrated the building story with the family and with the community, Young said. Succeeding Tucker is Lindsay Carney, who has shadowed her for the last 6 months, but she first got involved as a volunteer prior to that. Before her work at Ewing, Carney served as a librarian at the Normal Public Library and even worked briefly with Tucker at Milner Library. She holds education and history degrees from Knox College, where she graduated in 2005. She then went on to study library and information science in graduate school at the University of Illinois, where she graduated in 2007. She also holds facilities management credentials from the International Facilities Managers Association. Carney said she intends to continue the legacy of the Ewings and the legacy of Tucker, who has become an important part of the manor's history. It is all of those pieces. It's building on the foundation that Tony has already laid with the family, with the archives, and that is really imperative to me and really important to keep building on that and to make that a priority, Carney said. She continued, Tucker has started something here, and she is part of the history of this home as well. In her retirement, Tucker does not see herself completely separating from her longtime commitment to the manor and telling its story. Instead, Tucker says she plans to continue sharing that story through a series of books. She intends for the first book, Sunset Hill, to be ready by the end of 2027. And our last front page story is about Congress, titled Speaker and Trump to Meet Over Voter ID Crisis. This is a Reuters story, datelined Washington. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson was due to meet with President Donald Trump on Thursday in hopes of defusing a political crisis gripping Congress over a stalled package of national voting restrictions that the president views as his number one legislative priority. A day after a contentious closed-door meeting between Trump and Senate Republicans, hardline Trump allies led by U.S. Representative Ana Paulina Luna effectively shut down the House floor by refusing to support a measure allowing unrelated legislation to advance until the Senate passes the voter ID bill known as the Save America Act, which the Senate has tried and failed to pass five times since mid-March. Trump employed a similar tactic to pressure Senate Republicans on Wednesday by pulling out of a signing ceremony for a popular bipartisan housing bill that House and Senate Republican leaders hope to showcase as evidence that they are addressing the high cost of living, the top issue for voters in the November midterm elections that will determine whether Republicans retain their majorities in Congress. Hours after the Trump meeting, the Senate left a day early for a two-week July 4th break without any action on the Save America Act, despite mounting pressure on Senate Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader John Thune, from hardliners. I will not be voting to reopen the floor until the Senate gets back to Washington, Luna said in a social media post after their departure. John Thune is running and hiding because he does not want to get voter ID across the finish line. With only a slim 218 to 212 Republican majority, Johnson can afford to lose no more than two votes on any measure that faces unanimous opposition from Democrats. While Johnson's raucous caucus has caused him problems, he does not face the same challenges Thune does, where Senate rules effectively require bipartisan support of most legislation. At a Thursday news conference, eight of Luna's fellow hardliners emphasized their own opposition to moving forward on House bills while the Senate is out of session. I personally think we should not have any more legislation until the Senate comes back in session, said Representative Ralph Norman, a prominent member of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus. The Save America Act would require a photo ID to vote in federal elections and proof of U.S. citizenship to register, while compelling states to turn over their voter registration rolls to the federal government. The bill, which faces vehement opposition from Democrats, passed the House of Representatives in February but has since languished in the Senate. Trump also wants the bill to sharply restrict mail-in voting, which is a concern for Republicans worried that it could hurt turnout in rural areas. Critics, including Democrats, say the bill targets a nearly non-existent problem of non-citizen voting, which Trump falsely blamed for his 2020 loss to former President Joe Biden. They also warn that the legislation would disenfranchise American citizens who do not have ready access to a passport or birth certificate. Some Republicans have openly warned that Trump's unrelenting focus on the Save America Act could play into the hands of Democrats who hope to take control of the House and possibly the Senate in November and have been quick to seize on the issue. People are clearly struggling, and that is what public sentiment shows unequivocally, and Donald Trump has failed to solve that challenge, House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries told CNBC on Thursday. He just actually detonated a bipartisan housing bill that would help build housing in this country that is affordable for everyday Americans who are drowning and suffocating in Donald Trump's and the Republicans' failed economy. We move now to some state and local news. This story is headlined, State Says Chittick's Teacher a Hunter. Second faculty member facing grooming and abuse image charges. This story is Dateline Bloomington. A Chittick's junior high teacher has been denied pretrial release while he faces charges of grooming and possession of child sex abuse material in McLean County. Andrew M. Miller, 40, is the second Chittick's teacher arrested on grooming charges this year. He is charged with 40 counts of possession of child sex abuse material, one count of indecent solicitation of a child, and one count of grooming. Miller appeared Wednesday before Judge Amy McFarland for a detention hearing, which was rescheduled from Thursday, June 18th, at the defense's request. Assistant State's Attorney Aaron Frederick filed a petition to detain Miller, arguing he poses a danger that cannot be mitigated by any conditions of release. Attorney Josh Rinker represented Miller and asked McFarland to deny the petition and order he be released from custody. According to the probable cause statement Frederick presented Wednesday, Miller has been contacting teenagers and solicited them for images and video of child sex abuse material, sometimes with the threat of exposure and attempting to meet in person for sex. Frederick said Miller committed these offenses between 2014 and February 2026. He identified seven victims in Miller's 42 pending charges, all between the ages of 14 and 17 at the time of the reported abuse. Since Miller's arrest last week, another victim contacted authorities to report similar offenses, Frederick said. The McLean County State's Attorney's Office plans to file an additional 14 charges in Miller's case. The prosecutor also said three more victims were identified and would have led to even more charges, but for the statute of limitations. Frederick said Miller used his position as a teacher and cheerleading coach where he hunted for his victims, where he selected his victims, and where he found his victims. According to the probable cause statement, Miller also used social media accounts and false identities to solicit the abusive material, which the state said was saved in files to which only Miller had access and was under his sole possession. McLean County Unit 5 placed Miller on paid administrative leave in February after Bloomington police executed a search warrant on his classroom. After his arrest last week, McLean County Unit 5 officials said the district will be taking steps to move him to unpaid leave. Frederick argued that Miller should be detained and described possession of child sex abuse material as a violent and dangerous crime. He also said Miller's use of social media to find and abuse victims meant the court could not trust that he would not use the internet if he were released. Rinker argued a 4th District Appellate Court ruling, People v. Bartosik, in April, found that possession of child sex abuse material alone does not meet the threshold for a detention on the grounds of dangerousness. He said the state's perceived inability to apply monitoring systems that would ensure Miller does not use social media or the internet should not be used as a reason to deny Miller's release, saying there was a buffet of conditions to which Miller would agree to comply. Frederick argued a 2025 appellate case, People v. Popovich, counters Rinker's argument. He said the Bartosik case revolved around one image of an unidentifiable person that was downloaded from the internet, while the Popovich case, similar to the case facing Miller, involved named identifiable victims. Rinker argued his defendant should be released and would comply with any and all mitigating conditions the court might impose, including GPS ankle monitoring, no access to social media or the internet, home confinement, and submitting to a sex offender evaluation. He noted that Miller did not interfere with police's searching of his residence and allowing them in a second time, showing compliance with the law. Rinker also said Miller is the sole caretaker for his mother, has ties to the community, and does not have a criminal history. Frederick argued Miller's ties to the community show he was good at hiding his alleged activity. The fact that the defendant has not been caught is not mitigating, he said. Frederick also referenced an incident from 2019 in which McLean County Unit 5 investigated Miller's conduct with a minor during a cheer camp in another county. The prosecutor said Miller was accused of acting inappropriately by discussing sexual acts with the minor. Rinker objected to this being argued to determine Miller's detention status, as no formal charges were made. McFarland sustained but allowed the state to reference it in totality. In delivering her remarks and ultimate decision, McFarland said she wanted to be precise and concise, acknowledging the arguments from both prosecution and defense. She said there was ample and sufficient evidence that Miller had committed these offenses, which lined up with the timing of his teaching and coaching, that were eligible for detention. Regarding the dangerousness of the offenses or willingness to comply with court orders, McFarland acknowledged Miller had no criminal history, but she said this was only one factor. She said Miller used his position of power, of authority, of trust to exploit minors. The fact that some of his accusers are over 18 now does not diminish the dangerousness of those charges. McFarland ultimately said there were no conditions the court could impose to keep the public safe and ordered that he be detained pending trial. Miller is set for an arraignment July 29th in front of Judge William Yoder. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, June 26th, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.